Okay, so getting right into it today. We're diving into a case that honestly I think kind of freaks out most law students when they first come across it.
Yeah, I can see why.
It's Bilotti v. Bickhart. It's a New York case from way back in 1920.
Oh, yeah, that one.
But don't worry, we're going to break it down. It's a really important case for understanding property law, especially when we're talking about those tricky concepts of tacking and pervivity, which come up all the time with adverse possession claims.
Yeah, definitely. And it's not just theoretical stuff either. This case really gets into the nitty-gritty of how property disputes play out in the real world. You know how sometimes what's on paper, like in a deed, doesn't quite match up with what's actually happening on the ground?
Oh, yeah, all the time.
Well, Bilotti v. Bickhart is a perfect example of that.
Right.
We've got a hotel owner, Bickhart, who's claiming he owns a piece of land, even though it's not specifically included in his deed.
And it's not just like a tiny sliver of land either, right?
Right? It's actually a pretty sizable chunk of land. A whole section of his hotel is built on it, because the building was built decades earlier by a previous owner, and it turns out it encroached onto the neighboring property.
So let's back up a bit and get the full picture. This all takes place in the Bronx back in the late 1800s. And to really understand it, we're going straight to the source. We've got the actual court opinion from the New York Court of Appeals and a super detailed brief of the case.
Great sources.
So imagine this. We've got Bilotti, who owns Lot K, and then right next door, we've got Bickhart's predecessor, who owns lots H, I, and J, and there's an 1889 map of the area that shows where the property lines are supposed to be.
But here's where things get messy. In 1892, the guy who owns what will eventually become Bickhart's property, his name is Van Schaick, he builds a building. But get this, the building doesn't stay within his property lines. It actually sticks out onto Bilotti's Lot K by a whole 12 feet wide and 51 feet deep.
Whoa, so not just a little bit.
No, not at all. It's a significant encroachment. This is a substantial piece of land that's being taken up by this building.
Okay, so this isn't like a fence that's a foot over the line. We're talking a whole structure. Then what happens?
Well, in that same year, 1892, a guy named Riedel comes along and he buys Lot J. And guess what he does with that encroached area?
Let me guess. He puts it to good use.
Exactly. He sets up a saloon and a roadhouse. So it's not just some empty space. It's being actively used for business.
And is Riedel the one who built the building?
No, it was Van Schaick who built it. But Riedel's the one who starts using that encroached upon area for business.
Gotcha. So the building's already there. And then Riedel buys the lot and he's like perfect spot for a saloon.
Pretty much. And Riedel, and then later on, his heirs, they keep running their business there for years.
Okay, so then eventually Bickhart enters the scene.
Right. In 1906, Bickhart buys the property from Riedel's heirs, and he takes over the business, turns it into a hotel. But here's the catch, and this is spelled out right there in the case documents. The deed that Bickhart gets when he buys the property in 1906, it specifically leaves out that 12 by 51 foot strip of land where the building is encroaching.
Oh, that's not good.
No, not really. That missing piece of land is a major problem. It becomes the center of the legal battle that's about to go down.
So at this point, this whole situation has been going on for quite a while. We're talking from 1892 to 1914. That's 35 years with this building partly sitting on Bilotti's land. And finally, Bilotti says enough is enough. He takes Bickhart to court in 1914. He wants to get that land back. He wants Bickhart off of it. And he wants that part of the hotel that's trespassing to be torn down.
That's a pretty intense move after all those years.
Right. Like, why wait so long to sue? So now we're at the heart of the legal issue.
And that issue boils down to a couple of really important questions that any law student needs to grapple with. The first one is, did Bickhart actually gain legal ownership of that piece of land just because he and the previous owners had been using it for so long?
Yeah.
Could he successfully claim it through adverse possession by combining or tacking his time of possession with the time that Riedel and his heirs had it?
Right. Like, does all that time add up to give him ownership? And the second big question has to do with this concept of privity.
Right? How can there even be this legal connection, this privity, between Bickhart and those earlier owners when that specific piece of land wasn't officially given to him in the deed? If it's not in the paperwork, how can he argue that he's part of this unbroken chain of ownership for the purposes of adverse possession? These are the tough legal questions that the New York Court of Appeals had to figure out.
So what did they decide? Whose side did they take?
Well, in the end, the Court of Appeals ruled in favor of Bickhart. They said, yes, he did acquire legal title to that part of Lot K through adverse possession.
Wow. So even though it wasn't in his deed.
Exactly. And to understand how they came to that decision, we have to dig into the specifics of what makes up adverse possession legally.
Okay, so break it down for us. What is adverse possession exactly?
Basically, it's a legal way for someone to gain ownership of someone else's property by openly using it as their own for a certain period of time, which is set by law. In New York, back then, that was 20 years.
So you just have to use it like it's yours for 20 years and it's yours.
Well, it's not quite that simple. But that's the general idea. The court made it very clear that this possession has to be hostile, which might sound kind of aggressive, but it doesn't necessarily mean there's an actual fight or anything. It just means possessing the land as if it were yours without the real owner's permission and without acknowledging they have a better claim to the title.
Okay, I think I'm starting to get it.
Yeah.
But going back to that hostile element, does it matter that the first encroachment by that guy, Van Schaik, back in 1892 might have been an honest mistake, like maybe a surveying error or something when they were building the place?
That's a really good question, and the Bellotti case actually addresses that directly. The court said that even if that initial encroachment was a mistake, it doesn't automatically mean the hostility requirement isn't met. What really matters is that Riddell, and then later Bickhart, they both treated that land as their own openly and continuously for that required 20-year period.
So it's really about how they acted on the land, not just how the whole thing started?
Right. It's about showing a clear intention to possess and control the property, no matter why the encroachment happened in the first place. And of course, there are other key elements of adverse possession, too. Like, they have to have actually possessed it.
Meaning they were actually using it, like how they ran businesses there?
Exactly. Right. And it has to be open and notorious, meaning the possession is obvious and can't be hidden, which is pretty much a given when you've got a two-story building sticking out onto your neighbor's property.
Yeah, you can't really miss that. Then there's exclusive possession, meaning they're not sharing the use of that land with anyone else.
Right. And finally, it has to be continuous possession, meaning that use of the land can't be interrupted for that whole 20-year period. And in this case, we've got 35 years of uninterrupted use from 1892 to 1914.
So based on all that, it seems like they've pretty much checked all the boxes for adverse possession.
Yeah, but the real heart of the Bellotti decision, the part that makes it so important and still debated today, is how the court applied tacking and how they interpreted privity. Remember how Bickhart's deed specifically didn't include that strip of land? So how could he possibly benefit from all those years of possession by Riedel and his heirs? That's where the court's understanding of privity comes in.
Okay, I'm all ears. This is where it gets tricky.
So the court decided that privity, that necessary legal connection between people who are claiming adverse possession one after the other, it doesn't always have to be a formal transfer of ownership, like what you'd see in a deed that specifically mentions the dispute of property.
Okay, that's interesting. So what else could create this privity?
Well, the court looked at the situation as a whole, and they saw a clear pattern of the property being handed off from one person to the next, each one taking possession and control of the entire property, including that building that was partly on someone else's land. And the court said that kind of continuous transfer of possession, even if it's based on a more informal understanding or agreement, can be enough to establish privity.
So even though the official paperwork, the deed, didn't say, hey, we're also giving you this extra bit of land that our building's sitting on, the court looked at what was actually happening, how the property was being used and transferred, and they said, okay, it's clear they intended to hand over the whole thing, encroached land and all.
Yeah, you got it. And they actually use a really helpful analogy in one of the sources to explain this whole tacking idea. It's like a relay race. Each owner is passing the possession baton to the next one. As long as there's this clear and unbroken chain of that possessory interest, all those periods of possession can be added up to meet that 20-year requirement.
I like that analogy. It makes it much easier to understand.
Right. But there's another side of this story, too. It's important to remember that not everyone on the court agreed with this decision.
Oh, really? Tell me more.
Yeah, there was a strong dissenting opinion written by Justice Hogan. And his main point was basically this. Look, the deed is the official legal document that says who owns what. If Bickhart's deed specifically said he wasn't getting that piece of land, then how can we legally say he has a valid claim to it based on how the previous owners used it? Justice Hogan argued that what's written in the deed should be the deciding factor when it comes to figuring out privity.
So he was saying, stick to the paperwork, don't get caught up in all this informal transfer stuff.
Exactly. And that dissenting opinion brings up a really fundamental tension in property law.
Yeah.
It's that classic conflict between what the official legal documents say and what's actually happening on the ground with the land. And it makes you think hard about which one should carry more weight when you're trying to sort out these kinds of property disputes.
Yeah, it's like the letter of the law versus the spirit of the law. But okay, so stepping back a bit, why is this case, Bilotti v. Bickert, still so important for anyone who's studying property law today? Why are we talking about a case that's over 100 years old?
It's a great question, and there are a few key reasons why this case is still studied and debated today. First, it sets a really important precedent for figuring out those tricky boundary disputes. Think about how many properties probably have fences or even boardings that have been in the same spot for decades, but might actually be crossing property lines. This case gives us a legal framework for dealing with those situations where the real-world boundaries don't perfectly match up with what's on the maps and deeds.
Okay, so it's like a roadmap for how to approach these situations legally. But what about those more theoretical concepts like privity?
Well, Bilotti also really expands our understanding of privity when it comes to adverse possession. It makes it crystal clear that privity isn't only about what's written down in a deed. It also considers the clear intentions and actions of everyone involved in transferring that property. So that's a huge step beyond just relying on strict documentary evidence. And Bilotti is a perfect case to study if you really want to lock down your understanding of the five essential elements of adverse possession: hostile, actual, open and notorious, exclusive, and continuous.
Right. And seeing how each of those plays out in the Bilotti case makes it much easier to understand how they work in real-world situations.
Exactly. You can see how hostile doesn't have to mean some big fight. It's about how they acted as the owners. Actual means they were actually running a business there. Open and notorious is pretty obvious with a giant building exclusive. They weren't sharing the use of the land and continue. Well, they used it for 35 years straight, so that's definitely continuous.
Yeah, no breaks there. So for anyone listening who's going to be a lawyer someday, this case really shows that in property law, the deed isn't always the be-all and end-all. Sure, the official documents are super important, but courts also look at the reality of how the land is being used. You can't just stop at the chain of title. You've got to investigate who's been possessing the property, what they've been doing with it, and for how long, all that good stuff.
Absolutely. And if we zoom out and look at the bigger picture, Bilotti touches on some fascinating policy issues. Now, first glance, adverse possession might seem like a way for someone to unfairly snag someone else's land, but it actually serves some important purposes in our legal system. It helps to stabilize property rights over time, it clears up old, unresolved claims, and it generally favors putting land to good use. So if someone's been openly using a piece of property for a long time and they're actually doing something productive with it, the law might step in and recognize that, especially if the original owner hasn't bothered to assert their rights for ages.
So it's kind of like saying, use it or lose it, right? Mm-hmm.
In a way, yeah. So let's recap what we've learned from our deep dive into Bilotti v. Bickert. First, the case gives us clear guidance on how different owners can combine their time of possession to meet that 20-year requirement for adverse possession.
Yeah.
And it establishes that you don't always need a formal deed that specifically includes the disputed land to have that legal connection privity, as long as it's clear that everyone intended to transfer the entire property building in all way. And most importantly, it underscores just how crucial open, continuous, and exclusive possession is when you're building a case for adverse possession.
Great summary. We covered a lot of ground today.
We did. And it brings up a really interesting question that I want to leave you with something to think about as you keep exploring the world of property law. We live in a time now where we have incredibly detailed property records, high-tech surveying, and sophisticated ways to track who owns what. So in this modern world, how does this old concept of adverse possession, which is really all about physically occupying land over time, how does that still work? How do we balance the need for clear property rights and legal certainty with the reality of how land is being used on a daily basis? And how do we make sure that ancient property claims don't suddenly pop up and throw a wrench into things when people have been peacefully using land for decades? It's a fascinating puzzle to keep in mind as you delve deeper into the complexities of property law.
Definitely lots to think about. Well, that's all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into Bilotti v. Bickert. See you next time.
See you then.
Bye.